get over the fence, so we're gonna get trash, and we'll get garbage. And I was just getting ready to say, so what we gotta do is wait for the, we're adjourned, by the way.
Tomorrow, by tomorrow, let them go as soon as we can.
What he was saying, I'm just getting ready to talk to another chair, and we're on the crap.
We are and we are not considering, House Bill, 391. Just for the record, this is an informal hearing, just on the general subject of, the executive branch, because, the joint rules preclude us from, hearing the bill without 5 days' notice, until both, conferences on the budget are appointed, and that hasn't happened yet. So we're hearing it informally, we'll schedule it for a formal hearing, and scheduling, next week or beyond. And presumably, members will have, be familiar enough, we can deal with it at some dispatch at that time. But that's the best we can do at this time, because the way the uniform rules are written. We have Representative Sun is also present. We have, representatives from the governor's office, or general's office, I guess, and, you want to, why don't you both join in, because it seemed to work very well in State Paris. Let's see,
which bill was addressed by our State Affairs?
Let's see.
It could go ahead and come over here.
Oh, I see, that's the Senate State Affairs, it's the, Senate.
Well, now, you see, the Senate bill does not come over here, I thought that passed out of the Senate.
Was it heard yesterday?
The judiciary? I mean, that's.
And finance, but that's the Senate bill.
Yeah, but I'm surprised we haven't received it from the clerk, because it was heard yesterday. Well, in any case, the version for you to look at is, the House State Affairs CS for, 706. And that's part of the draft you'd rather work off of, isn't it? Although you might tell us, apparent differences.
As a matter of fact, the CS for 706 that was introduced in State Affairs incorporated all the changes that existed in the bill that just passed the Senate, except for the amendments that were made on the floor of the Senate, which is to the railroad.
Yeah, okay.
Everything else, so all those amendments except for those are included in this bill.
Yeah, only the railroad was dealt with.
That's right.
They included into the railroad amendment?
They included it. They were, the railroad was excluded from the Senate.
That's a deal.
For 11 to 9, that's
it. Really?
You point to that.
Yeah, let's, start with that.
Oh, yeah, would you, please both identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Randall Burns, Special Assistant to the Attorney General.
And Susan Cox is the Senator.
Representative Greenberg is not present as well.
Okay.
We got Senator.
Mr. Chairman, on page 21 of, State Assistant to House Bill 706, line 21 is where this bill includes the railroad, and this language was deleted and changed to read in the Senate bill, University of Alaska, public or quasi-public corporations, and boards and commissions,
21.
Excluding the Alaska railroad. So they put in language to specifically exclude them.
Use your method. I have. I hate to express it.
Okay. Why don't you back the first word for the day?
Eureka. I'm listening.
Okay, why don't you just walk us through the bill then?
Okay. There's one other place where they also amended the bill to talk about the railroad, and that is on page, they did it over on page,
which version?
On your version, 706, it would be on page 26 of your bill. And what they have done is, it says, line 14, we're amending the corporation employees, which refers to the railroad. What they have done is they have taken out the, on line 17, the language where we had added the ethics bill. They've removed that, and then they've added language that says, and we've provided this to you if this is in the files, language that says, however, no later than January 1, the corporation shall adopt a code of ethics for its directors and employees that is the standard equivalent to that adopted in AS 39. So they took out the coverage of the code of ethics, but added language saying they should adopt the code substantially equivalent
by when?
January 1. Excuse me?
By when?
January 1 of 87.
Yes, if you contrast page 20 in the House version, page 26, line 17, and in the Senate version, page 26, lines 3 through 5.
Okay. They overlooked one other amendment on the floor of the Senate, but the revised statute has indicated that the intent would be to interpret, and I can show you where that is also, which would be on page 22 of Senate 706, right at the end of line 5 on page 22. The definition of Board of Commission says including the Alaska Railroad. They neglected to delete that, but the revised statute will delete that from their bill. Starting on page 1 then of the bill,
which version are you using?
706. Representative Greenberg, I might. This bill includes all the changes that were in Senate Bill 391 except the railroad.
Okay.
This first article talks about declarations of policy. Ordinarily, sometimes it's frowned upon to put legislative declarations into statute. We've done that here because we think it's important that the legislative purpose behind an ethics bill be placed in statute, so that's why this first section deals with, we just put that language in statute. I don't know how much time you want me to.
Not much.
Well, on the other hand, that is.
Well, if we have questions, though, then we'll
be on. That is important because what triggered, if I may, what triggered this entire issue several years ago was the ruling of the Attorney General that the common law imposed an ethical standard. Does this declaration of policy state an intent to repeal or supersede the common law?
It's not here. It's found in the applicability section of it, but it does state that it supersedes the common law.
And you don't think that's okay? It's not necessarily. Could you point to that?
Sure. It's on page. It'll be on page 20. Line 16, subsection B.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. On page 2 of the bill, the article 2 starts the code of ethics. The SOBO code, if I might, just take a little time on this first section and direct the committee's attention to the statements that are found on starting on line 10 and 11, where it says the legislature further recognizes, one, in a representative democracy, the representatives are drawn from society and therefore cannot and should not be without personal and financial interests in the decisions and policies of government. Two, that people who serve as public officers retain their rights to interests of a personal and financial nature. And three, that the standards of ethical conduct for members of the executive branch need to distinguish between minor and inconsequential conflicts that are unavoidable in a free society and those conflicts that are substantial material. And then we define in subsection B what we consider to be substantial impropriety. We say that there is no substantial impropriety if one, a public officer's personal or financial interest in the matter is insignificant or of a type that's possessed generally by the public or a large class of persons, or two, the action or influence would have an insignificant or contextual effect on the matter. And then in subsection three, we ask that the Attorney General, the designated supervisors, hearing officers, and the board be guided by this. And the reason we put this in here is we wish to indicate that, to set forth the test, in a sense, that would be used in judging these other sections so that people are aware that we are trying to distinguish between insignificant and actual major conflicts that are a concern to the public.
Yeah, this is the first, this is the first time I've had a chance to look at this, obviously. The reference on lines 28 and 29, the hearing officers. The hearing officers being quasi-judicial officers. Is it the intent of the sponsor of this bill that hearing officers would be solely subject to this, or would they also be subject to the judicial canon?
I'm assuming that any hearing officer, if of course they were an attorney, some hearing officers are not, would certainly be subject to the code of ethics for professional responsibility.
I'm not talking about the professional responsibilities, unless they're a lawyer, they're
right,
not. I'm talking about the judicial thing.
Didn't address that, and I haven't even really thought about it. Do you have a response to that?
Representative Greenberg, this intent is just to direct hearing officers who are interpreting this code of ethics to direct their attention to the scope of the clause, since they will be giving opinions that the bill sets up a procedure. If there is probable cause to believe that a violation has occurred, then a hearing officer is hired to hear the matter, and this is directing them to the interpretation of the judicial code.
I see. I understand precisely what you're saying, and that language on subsection C relates not to the hearing officer in his own personal affairs, but in the conduct of his administrative decision. And that clarifies that. However, going back to my earlier question in the broader sense, if there is a hearing officer in the executive branch, example, hearing appeals in AFDC cases or something like that, would they be subject to this code of ethics in the executive branch or the judicial canon or both?
They would not, in my opinion, they would not be subject to this bill because they were on contract to the state. They're not considered under this bill employees of the state.
It depends. There are hearing officers who are
full time, right? Full time of the
state. And they would be subject to this. We haven't addressed the
judiciary is not covered in this bill.
No, I understand that. But the judiciary is in its canons of ethics, as Randall well knows. That's just something that somebody ought to think about. It's not a very large group at this point. There's a group that will grow in size.
Okay.
I just want to tell the committee, too, this business of this section, not the part about the hearing officers, but this section, particularly that relates to minor and inconsequential conflict, that's sort of key because that's the tone for the rest of the bill. As Randall thought, he'd give an example as we go along here. I mean, people ask whether there's such and such a violation, and he'll say, well, no, because of the language at the beginning here that says it's minor and inconsequential.
I just want to flag that for later discussion.
Sure.
I'm not sure that we need to spend as much time placing in statute the authority of, in fact, encouraging people to have personal and financial interests that affect their decisions and the policy of the government. Seems to go a little bit too far the other way, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, you can flag it and talk about it. Let's do a run through.
Just another question, particularly with the exception on page 2, lines 23 through 25. There is similar language in the legislative ethics code. How similar is it? How does it differ?
Can you bring your...
Yeah.
We can take a look here. I think we've got a copy here.
Yeah, I guess
for future work on this, it would be helpful to have a copy of our ethics code. Some of us spent a lot of time on that.
Right.
What was that?
I think that should be something.
If I may
some of us have never read it.
In 2460.030, which addresses conflict of interest in the legislative ethics bill, it says conflicts of interest are prohibited, but there is not a conflict of interest as to a specific matter. There is no substantial impropriety or appearance of impropriety because the person's interest is relatively insignificant. Person's authority is relatively far removed from any official action that could reasonably be affected by the potential conflict of interest, provided that no attempt has been made to remove the appearance of impropriety by delegating responsibility to officials. That's fairly similar.
Remember,
the judicial canon, with which I am a little more familiar than I am with the other canon, do talk about an appearance of an impropriety, and that's very important from a judicial point of view. The legislature talks about appearance of impropriety. That's obviously very important from the point of view of this branch of government. You don't, on line 22, talk in terms of an appearance of impropriety, and I think that should be equally important from the executive point of view. Why isn't that in there?
President Bloomberg, the common law and the problem that we have with interpreting the common law is that the appearance of impropriety or actual impropriety are the standards set. The reason that we have proposed a bill is to set out specific standards and specific guidelines without dealing in appearances, so that people can have very specific guidance in their actions rather than trying to ascertain for themselves whether something looks bad to someone else. Certainly, we have tried to incorporate the fairest standards and yet high standards, but we have specifically avoided appearance problems, and that is exactly the purpose of putting this in the statute.
I think that will be perceived by the public if they become aware of it as a significant shortcoming, because if you have three branches of government and two are admonished to avoid even the appearance of an impropriety, having a bill from the executive branch that does not admonish itself to avoid even the appearance of an impropriety is significantly weaker in the public mind. And I would like you to consider whether we ought to add something that is even the appearance of an impropriety, because that's what led to the events of last summer.
If I Mr. Chairman, one of the problems, though, as Susan pointed out, is that in fact that's an undefined. And one of the opinion that gave rise to the legislative ethics and from the original bill and the failure of it to pass, one of the attempts was to define the appearance of impropriety and solve the problem that everyone was working under, which was this very strict standard, which in some situations is perhaps overly strict, and put in place instead specific standards of conduct so that it's much more clearer as opposed to this appearance of impropriety where everyone sort of, like jello, you know, you move in the wrong way and you're suddenly falling under.
If the other two branches have traditionally, and the common law in this area, has admonished the executive to avoid even the appearance of an impropriety, and we have done it in the legislative language, which you just read to us, and it's certainly been there for years in the judicial canon for ethics, I see no greater difference in defining it for the executive branch, and it will be perceived as a much weaker statute without it.
Let's just flag this right now.
Well, I did have sort of the same point. I mean, stay on it because it is going to set the tone for the rest of what we do here. I agree with Max, and when we dealt with the legislative ethics code, I think there was a fairly compelling argument made when the question was raised about adding the executive branch into that code, that really a different level of obligation ought to be imposed on the legislators because we were part-time, and that in fact, if anything, there ought to be a higher standard for full-time public employees. Max has highlighted, I think, one example where this code doesn't reflect that. I think I've identified another because I think that the standard in here that we just read from the legislative ethics code could arguably be much stronger. I think you won't see much sympathy here with the idea, and more importantly, I think you're going to see a lot of us looking carefully at the legislative ethics code to make sure that we are not under any heavier obligation than full-time public service.
Representative Flossen, if I may, I think this sort of ethics has higher standards for the executive branch than the legislative ethics bill, and I think you'll see that as we go through this.
Okay, we will, except it doesn't start very well because there's nothing in the legislative code of ethics that, that encourages and puts into statute the right to have an, in a personal interest that also could be influenced by your official actions, which this could have.
Certainly isn't our intent to encourage conflict of interest.
The next section, section 120, misuse of official position, on top of page 3, maybe it'll be easier just to run through this. It says the public officer may not use or attempt to use an official position for personal gain and may not intentionally secure or grant unwarranted benefits or treatment for any person. And B, then, there's a series of prohibitions. The public officer may not...
I'm sorry. Sure. I'm still trying to set the stage for this. Public official, as I, or okay. officer, as I understand it, is defined as any public employee, classified, exempt, or non-exempt.
Okay.
So while in our code we exempt the lower-level positions, lower-paid positions, this code does not.
That's correct.
So the lowest-paid secretary in state service would be...
It's covered by the fact.
Okay.
That's correct.
Let me go through this.
And it also covers members of boards and commissions who are appointed by the governor or whoever else. It covers all members of boards and commissions as well, of all corporations and quasi public corporations.
Okay. Acting in their capacity.
That's right, acting in their capacity.
Yeah, then we got another conflict there between the legislature and the executive branch. Here we are. Setting out one set of the federal rules, and then are you flagging that?
Yep.
Okay. The way I feel about it is we're gonna. I think the executive branch should have the exact same set of standards as the legislature. In this, particularly in this case, I think it's range under over 17 is in our conflict or in our
right.
Court ethics.
Of course, on the other hand, maybe the solution to your point of view is for us to
put everybody
in.
If I might just comment on that briefly, one of our concerns was that there are certainly substantial numbers of people in the executive branch whose opportunities to benefit from their official position are just as great as anyone who may be in the partially exempt or exempt classification and who can use their position to benefit members of their family and others. And if it's a legitimate code of ethics, then there's nothing to, it wouldn't be any more onerous to have them under the bill as it would for an exempt or partially exempt employee.
Why don't we first give me an example?
The use of information, one of the things that we'll be talking about here is the use of information, and obviously one of the anyone in the state government has access to information that may be confidential and can benefit themselves financially or personally. For instance, in DNR, there's a considerable amount of employees who have access to information regarding leases and homesteads and sales and giveaway programs and things of that nature that could be of significant value to them. If they have used that information to their personal or their family's benefit, and they would not, if it was like a range of 19, probably wouldn't be covered, or 17 or 18 wouldn't be covered by the Act. So we have imposed it upon everyone.
We've seen, using that example, DNR, I don't know for sure, but it seems to me that they have regulations within their own department. Really, it might be like a company going out on a sweep base, and they have their own set of guidelines. Their employees or members of their families are not entitled to this. Am I right or wrong?
They have regulations for certain kinds of positions, but the point is, if you're setting standards for everyone, what's the harm, and where is the harm to the classified service? If they are covered by an ethics code. If they're legitimate standards, then the public ought to be reassured that everyone is subject to those standards, not just some people. Then you really get into a difficult problem of drawing the line of why at range 19 or why at range 20 and who should or shouldn't be subject to what would we have been at least advertising as a fairly strict standard for conduct in the executive branch.
These are all preliminary questions, and I know you're anxious to get into the
meat of it. That's fine. Not at all.
But with regard to classified employees, is there any problem here with interfering with the collective bargaining agreement?
No, Representative Clarkson, we've put in several provisions in here that address collective bargaining. One provision says that the collective bargaining process cannot negotiate any terms differently from this bill, which is not subject to negotiation. Secondly, if an agency, if the employing agency has a problem which they perceive as a discipline problem for misconduct, they can go ahead and discipline subject to the principles of just cause and either a personnel rule or collective bargaining agreement, whatever is applicable, without waiting for a determination under the ethics bill. This provides civil penalties if, in fact, a violation is found, and we consider the strength of this to be the giving of advice and preventing conflicts and problems. But the agency still has control over its employees to the extent it does currently.
Okay, those are two important elements. How do you deal with the application of this for someone who's currently under a collective bargaining agreement? Is that legal? Simply change the terms of their employment in effect by imposing an ethics code on them during a contract term?
Well, the code of ethics does not become effective until January 1, 2007. All contracts expire before that, although we haven't addressed that issue previously. But I see no problem in that. Currently, the personnel rules provide for some fairly general standards. I think some of these are stricter than the personnel rules that exist, but they are operating under the personnel rules.
So you're confident we wouldn't conflict with any collective bargaining agreement?
No. Okay. No, and in fact, we've had three hearings, three different committees, or what, 10 hearings at least, and APEA has been coming in, they're the only one that has been coming in, and has never adjusted on that basis.
Have they supported the legislation?
In general, yes, although initially they were against the system, severely reducing.
I'm focusing now on page 3, line 4, where it uses the term intentional. And I thought of that for a minute, and I think that's wise to have that in there, because there's so many unintentional things that can occur in the real world. I don't see that on line 6, and you have some language in these subsections, 1 through 5, that allude to an intent. But what I'm wondering if there's a reason that you don't have the word intentionally between the words officer and may, to provide the same protection from inadvertent misjudgments or something that may have been reasonably put in line for.
President Gruberg, if I might, like, for instance, it would be difficult for someone.
I'm sorry, yes, of course it would be between may and not, yes.
It would be difficult for someone to unintentionally seek other employment or contracts for the use of their official position.
I understand that implies, but some of the other language, well, particularly like in the subsection 3.
Yeah, well, one of the examples that Representative Miller was referring to earlier is where we get into there, we base that on the scope of code. And for instance, one of the things that has come up when we've been talking about the use of state time property equipment is, for instance, let's say you need to call your school because your daughter is sick or something like that. Clearly, that's what the scope of code is going to, and obviously, that's not a significant matter. It's not, we're not misusing official position, and so we're not talking about those kinds of uses of state time property and abuse, and that's the purpose of that first section of the code, to set that out.
I understand.
So if we've done that as opposed to sticking in a word like intentional.
I think you might consider whether, as well as having, you know, you're not always going to have somebody refer back and forth to every section in this looking at it. I think it might clarify it, and I'd like you to consider where we might put that in there, because I want, you know, my position is a little different than Don's is on what he mentioned back here on the financial interest. I think that the people do have to, to attract good people, you're going to have people who have been out in the real world and been successful. And the public, I think, understands that. And they're going to have situations they get into because just in the nature of life. But if you have it so it's intentional, and that's real clear in here, then that's more realistic standard, and I would like you to consider that. I'm not up for that.
So I have a real, real general question. Once this thing passes, how is the state, I guess maybe through the Attorney General's office or the Governor's office, going to relay this on to the state employees so they know what's right and what's wrong? And is this in the form of a bill, or you can have a little booklet, and something like this, or who's going to go?
I'm sure that's the kind of thing that's been considered, is it would be some kind of a brochure or something that might come from either the governor's office or the department. Something of that nature. We also, by the way, have already been met with every department in what we call our dog and pony show. So we went over the sections, particularly the sections of the code that we're going over now, with commissioners, deputy commissioners, division directors, and executive directors of the boards and commissions. So they understood what we were getting at. So there was, and took a lot of input from those, so that they're generally aware of what this is and what we are drafting to begin with. And then once it's passed, obviously there would be part of the reason for the 6 months before the effective date, and they allow people time to be surprised with the code of conduct.
But who's going to write the report?
I'm assuming it would be the AG's office or Department of Education in conjunction with that. With the AG's office.
Mm-hmm.
That's a few
sentences,
but
well, they've done a pretty good job writing money on insurance brokers. Nobody can read insurance policies, but I can even read insurance brokers.
They should have something like that for money.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe we'll just
have
to get
it.
It's been years. Yeah, it's been years since it's been available.
No, it's
back in the bookstore. I saw it in the bookstore just the other day.
Yeah.
I must have a new edition. I don't know how far we're moving down the page here, but I know that coercion is not defined, at least in the definition on line 18. Is there, do you have a sense of that? I know there's a long depth of definition of supervisor, and I suppose maybe there's some help in there, but what's your thinking on coercion?
If I might, there was originally in the original bill two other provisions that were struck out of the Senate as being somewhat controversial. One of them was dealing with what we call the Amway provision, which precluded supervisors and having selling goods and services for the subordinate. And another provision going to what was the other one? I can't remember. What did you say? Close and prohibited close economic associations between supervisors and subordinates. And those were deleted in preference to this language that we also had in the bill, which what the general statement, which in fact it is an attempt to benefit. And I think the real issue is this, Representative Hoffman. One of the things that we did discover when we were doing going to the various departments is there's a lot of concern about the use of a supervisor's position to sort of coerce their subordinates into buying things or participating, or and the fear that, for instance, in some cases people are being, who are in fact friends of the supervisor, being promoted over others. So we wanted to just generally talk about the idea of somehow abuse of one's official position through coercion of employees to engage in some kind of, and in this case we defined it as a personal or financial interest. In other words, sort of coerce an employee to either, for instance, buy a boat or come in on a boat with him, or suggest that he do this subtly, things of that kind of nature that we're talking about when we use the word coercion. We did not define it, but we were getting to the idea of abuse of position by coercing them, basically putting a lot of pressure on them.
If you're talking about a subordinate, almost any action, any personal relationship is impliedly coercive. That is, I go to my administrative assistant and say that I would like to go in with you on a boat. Now, most of us would assume that that would be an arm's length thing, but it certainly could be interpreted to be coercive simply because of the implied threat.
On whose part, then?
Well, and let me suggest what the legislative ethics answer to that was. Mm-hmm. Was to provide two levels of two levels of conflict. The first level of conflict had to be disclosed, but was not illegal. And what had to be disclosed was precisely close economic associations with other employees. And then the second level, of course, which was illegal. Has any consideration been given to imposing a disclosure requirement for some of the things like we're talking about here?
We've talked about it, but when we had there was a prohibition in here that simply could not be there. So we have not talked about it since that language came out, a further change to that in terms of reporting of a close economic relationship or something of that nature.
Well, that would make it tremendously complicated, but I guess we went through this with the legislative ethics code and concluded that there was a middle ground, which was disclosure.
One of the problems is that even in your bill, the legislative ethics, close economic association is not defined, and that was one of the complaints about even arguing the language, what is a close economic association? And as you well know, they defined that, I think, for Senator Kelly as 0.5%. The relationship. So there's through opinions and things of that, you'll come up with a definition. But that was one of the other problems with it, is they just didn't, you know, if people kept saying, you mean I can't even have own a boat together, we go fishing together, and that's a close economic association. And that's probably even more prevalent within the executive branch because of the ongoing relationship with employees working together.
Yeah, but again, we softened that because it was a disclosure requirement
right.
only.
Right.
There wasn't a prohibition on buying a boat with somebody.
I understand.
I'm buying a house from a legislative
right.
employee.
Right. I have
not
no,
prohibited.
I certainly not object to that. I mean, I think that's a
well, it complicates your
conflict. Right.
But
it really
was.
That's a reasonable compromise.
Let me ask you a real quick question. Would this be the place, or is it covered elsewhere? I can't recall. If you had an attempt to benefit a personal, financial, or political interest through coercion, somebody comes in and says that we're having. Campaign tonight for Senator Joe. Sure would appreciate seeing you there at the thing. By the way, it's $50.
Personal interest is defined as including an interest in the political party.
Oh, okay. No,
okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And there already are statutes that would basically prohibit that.
Yeah, I know there are.
Right.
But people will look in the ethics code first.
Right.
Because it seems like the most logical. Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we go on? If there's no more question on that, let's go on to improper gifts.
Okay. Okay, this next section has gone through, this is probably one of the most controversial, has gone through some amendments. It says now that a public officer may not solicit, accept, receive directly or indirectly a gift, whether then there's a laundry list here, money, service, loan, travel, entertainment, hospitality, employment, promise, or any other form. That is a benefit to the officer's personal or financial interest under circumstances in which it could reasonably be inferred that the gift is intended to influence the performance of official duties, actions, or judgments. Then in B, it allows the receipt of a gift to value in excess of $50, except that it must, any gift over $50 would have to be reported, including its value and the giver. And in C, says that a designated supervisor can request guidance from the Attorney General concerning his acceptance. One of the things that we have done, one of the most controversial aspects of this was the problem that many departments have with the idea, and I'm sure some of you are aware of this problem in the legislative branch as well, the idea of, for instance, travel provided to you and your official capacity. And the question of whether or not that would be considered a gift or not a gift. A good example is when we were talking to the Department of Commerce, their goal in life is to encourage the development of industry in Alaska. And so they have a lot of interface with private companies and things like that, many of whom are interested in seeing, having people in commerce come and look at what they're doing, what they're doing, what kinds of things they're engaged in. And the question is whether or not that's a legitimate quote, if that's considered a gift under this, because right now they are in fact fairly frequently utilizing or taking advantage of offers made by private corporations to, for instance, let's, for example, we've been using Fly Down to Ketchikan to look at the installation of a filter on a water system in a pulp mill that they've installed so that DEC can see how it works and whether or not they want to encourage other plants to use that and things of that nature. We decided, and after some talk had put in an amendment in the Senate that was deleted because they figured it was opened it up too much, and with which we agreed. We were just trying to come to some compromise. But what we did do is change this so that it says specifically that the gift must be made to benefit an officer's personal or financial interest. So that in fact, and what we're trying to get at, if the gift really benefits not the individual but the agency and that person's capacity of going out to see what this, you know, this pump mill does and how it works and what this piece of equipment does, it's not really benefiting the individual. It's not a personal benefit. It's really a benefit that's accruing to the state and in his capacity. But then that kind of thing would be allowable. And so that's how we ended up compromising on it. I think it's a legitimate compromise. But what we really are trying to prohibit here is basically the person getting, you know, under the table a ticket to Hawaii if they make sure that this person's grant or loan gets approved, or money or trip or whatever it might be, and not the obvious taking advantage of a trip that otherwise stated at the foreclosure form.
So, you know, let me, I got two questions, and just triggered the second one. Mm-hmm. Remember about 2 or 3 years ago, Alaska Airlines or Western had this $100, whatever,
Amigo fare.
Yeah. How about that Amigo fare? Mm-hmm. I forget the details. Anyway, same employees for traveling and state business and accruing points or numbers or whatever it was, which they cashed in later for personal benefit. Now, does that apply? Or has that been yet? I think it's wrong myself.
There hasn't been, we haven't considered that in this situation. I don't think that would be covered here because I don't think those are circumstances in which it could be inferred that Alaska Airlines is intending to influence the performance of the public officers.
Yeah, but public officers taking advantage of the situation.
Sure, but that's not, so what I'm saying is it's not covered by this specific section. The question's been raised.
I'm not so sure. They're trying to encourage them to travel, official business.
Mm-hmm. But that's not intending to influence the performance, well, I don't think Alaska Airlines is giving the gift to get any official action from state employees. It's much less.
Let me use a more realistic example. Let's use the one now of the, what is it called, the gold card?
Yeah.
People have, or for Western, it's whatever it is, travel pass. Again, anyone who flies, basically state employees, I'm sure, are taking credit on their cards if they're flying to the state. I'm sure that's, in my opinion, that's covered by the inconsequential insignificant. It isn't having any impact on their official duties. It's not influencing them their decision, and therefore would not be prohibited by this.
But is a state paying for it? I mean, I just, you know, they're right. They're getting a benefit because they're in state employees, and they're in the state for nothing.
And the act is being performed or influenced is the act of traveling on state dollars.
Yeah.
And I know that there are public employees who travel, including the legislative branch, who travel at least partially for the purpose of accruing.
Well, I mean, if someone is scheduling a trip only because they need to get a couple more miles so they can get a free ticket, that may be, if that's what you're saying, if that's what you're implying, it's probably an improper trip, or they may not have justified business, and that's a different matter, but that's not addressed by this
disciplinary
section.
Question.
That's right. I really think that's a different issue.
Mr. Kernberg, and Mr. This is, and I'm looking at subsection A, this is focused on the recipient of the gift. Subsection B would seem to apply to the governor and lieutenant governor, again focusing on the recipient.
Mm-hmm. We've interpreted D to mean simply make it clear that gifts are not, a campaign contribution is not considered a gift under this section. That's all that's saying.
Okay. My concern is that
It seems to me that if you want to stop the gifts being given, you should look not only at the recipient, but also the giver. Because there are two people that are, you know, assuming that there are, you may have a person in the executive branch who is receiving a gift. You may also have a person in the executive branch who is giving a gift. Either, and I can see pressure being put on a person in the executive branch to donate either to, et cetera. The thing I'm concerned about is that it, I think it should also be illegal for somebody to give a gift under illegal circumstances if they happen to be in the executive branch. And that way, not only do you shut them down, you shut the recipients down here if they're in the executive branch under this code, or in the legislative branch under the legislative code, but you shut down the giver too. And the giver then also, it makes it easier to refuse to buckle under to the pressure, to say, hey, you know, not only are you going to be illegal by doing this, I'm going to be illegal for giving it to you too.
Okay, but now are you, let me make sure, are you referring then, if the giver is, for instance, outside the executive branch, like let's say?
No. So I'm talking about somebody in the executive branch. I'm not disputing that people outside should be discouraged from doing this.
Could you give me an example of
sure.
where you think that will have that
sure.
come into play?
Let us say somebody goes, let us say the governor goes to Mr. Secretary, or Ms. Secretary in some branch, and says, I want $100 from you. That's clearly illegal, you know, for my campaign. He says, I want this. I think that not only that should, at least I'd like to consider, that not only being illegal for the governor to do that, but it would be illegal for the donor, too. Because they're both acting illegally. And that could be done very simply by adding on line 20 the word give.
Yep. I sort of think it goes down the purview of the legislation, because the intent is to regulate the ethics of government employees. By the way, your compromise in subsection A is great. I'm even thinking of proposing it to be added to the legislative ethics code, because we're obviously having a problem with gifts of travel, for example.
And I do think
this would resolve it.
It comes under the title.
That travel.
This is not limited by the title to the executive branch.
Do you think? Yeah. Chapter 52 is the last executive branch ethics.
No, the
title.
It's wide enough.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it frankly would cover judicial branch.
Mr. Taylor had a question.
Yeah. As far as I know, we had one act of criminal conduct in the legislature that resulted in a conviction. Since then, we've had a governor that said, charged with using his power by having birthday parties. State employees contribute $100 and then there was an impeachment process brought based upon coercive conduct towards state employees, which resulted in one man's death.
Yeah.
There was some connection. Maybe we want to discuss that. Why in the world are we sitting here flailing ourselves in the legislature when the system has worked in the past? Are we so fearful of public confidence out there that this is how we reassure public confidence?
I don't understand your question.
I don't understand the purpose of about half of this, because what you're really talking about is it's okay if it's a campaign contribution.
Right.
Guy sets up and files immediately. As soon as he gets into office, and from there on out, he writes them all off as quote campaign contribution. Dodges the whole thing. The other guy trying to do it morally and ethically never would have taken anything like that in the first place. Yet the same guy might think it would be very appropriate to get on a free jet and go to Kenai and play basketball, because he isn't getting any benefit out of it. He's basically making a contribution of his own time. Now, I don't know how you're going to regulate common sense and morality and do it in a piece of paper. I really don't. If you got some criminal laws on the books, enforce the criminal laws when you've got a crime. But try to muck around with everybody, whether a guy's getting get mileage credit, flying to Fairbanks and back or not. There's administrative things to take care of that. And you know, the TR number can be utilized, and the airport can be, in, the carrier can be instructed that the credit returns back to the state, and the state gets X number of free tickets. That's no big thing. It's because no bureaucrat over here wants to do that, is why it hasn't been done, because nobody in Department of Administration wants to do it. It's all too cozy for everybody. But they're going to go right on doing it, Randy. There's 15 ways to dodge this sucker when we're done with it. You just can't legislate common sense or morality and do it very successfully. And I thought, as far as I'm concerned, that this thing is going to accomplish very little other than to show the public that we, the legislature, can just really beat up on ourselves whenever somebody else goes out and does bad acts.
This doesn't cover the legislature.
Doesn't cover the legislature?
No, we've already got it. We passed ours 2 years ago. This was the executive.
3 years.
I might also.
Go ahead.
Well, the other reason for adopting that specific code is to solve the problem that currently exists still with the executive branch, which is that we're working under the common law, and it's extraordinarily vague, and we have lots of problems, for instance, in interpreting that as it applies to board commission members and their performance, not only for. And that's another reason besides the legitimate reason that, in fact, 2 years ago when you all adopted your code was the reason that we were working on one at that time, but it just didn't pass. But that was the primary and the original reason for this bill was to solve the current dilemma, which is that we are covered by the common law, which is really vague and unworkable, and we need to come up with specific standards so that, in fact, hopefully we can avoid some of the problems that you're concerned about. Because people will know it.
Right.
So. Okay, moving right along. We go to 140.
Okay, section 140 is the improper use of disclosure of information. This was the subject of some discussion in House State Affairs and received its major amendments there.
I thought you said House State Affairs did the same thing as the Senate.
They started with the same bill.
Oh.
They then made this change that we're about to talk about.
May I interrupt?
Sure.
It seems to me that one of the real important aspects, and I'm going back to the subsection D, that this subsection D is one of the extremely important aspects of the subsection. And what you're basically saying is, as I understand it here, that this law, this new statute here, is not intended to apply anything additional to an elective, if to an elective candidate, than other existing law.
That's right.
And that's a very important policy decision that's being made. And my question is, I'm not doing anything other than putting a bee in your bonnet, maybe, whether we wish to make that particular policy decision. Has there been, in any of the committees that have discussed this so far, Randall and Susan, has there been any discussion on that particular point, whether in fact we should impose any additional type of ethical requirements in the giving of a gift to a gubernatorial candidate? And that's one of the issues in here that will really attract public interest and scrutiny.
One of the things is that there are already prohibitions on that in statute. And all this is saying is that we're just clarifying here that as long as you give the gift appropriately, i.e. not on the work force, you're not forced to do it, and those are already covered by statute, then you may go ahead and contribute to a candidate for elective office, and that won't be considered a gift. This has received zero discussion in any other committee.
However, I'd like to bring up, I believe that it was raised by the Senate Committee on Procurement and Ethics, which was considered another a very early draft last fall. And when we talked about the gift section, I'm pretty sure that that was where this came up, that they wanted to make it clear as they were going through. It sounded like gift would apply to the definition of a gift covered a campaign contribution, and it was their request that we specifically exempt campaign contributions.
So they wanted to go to this kind of a
right, and that's the reason that was added, as I recall.
Fine, I have nothing further. We're going to go for about another 10 minutes.
Okay. In subsection A on page 4. We're talking about the proper use of podium information. This just says that a current, and this is the first time we use, or former, the first time we use former, may not disclose or use information gained in the course of or by reason of the officer's official duties that could result in the receipt of a benefit for the officer or an immediate family member unless the information has also been disseminated. Now, the word disseminated from this phrase has had some controversy. It started out as in the Senate bill, it said, communicated, and was then changed from communicated to disseminated in the Senate. In the House State Affairs Committee, there was a desire, basically because of some concern with the APEA, that there wasn't any definition of what disseminated means. So then we came up with, in subsections B and C, what the committee felt was a definition of the term disseminated. And so in B, the purpose of this section, and I'm certainly willing to talk about that briefly, is there's some concern about whether or not information is, quote, available. Most anything that's in a public file is, quote, available to the public. And we could have used, unless an information is not available to the public. We did not use the word available. We started with communicated. Because our feeling is, that even though the information is public and it's sitting in those files, nobody knows it's there except the employees who work there. And that a member of the public, per se, can't do anything with that information because they don't even know it exists. Mm-hmm. So that before a member of the executive branch could act on that information, benefit themselves personally, for instance, make an investment decision, make a land purchase decision, do any number of things that information may allow them to do, at first it had to have been disseminated in some way publicly. And after that had occurred, then it was more fair. Everyone had the same advantage in some senses, and the public employees had been put forward. So we came a step above simple availability. We communicated, was changed to disseminated, and then was defined now in B and C. The reason for C is there was some concern, again expressed by the APEA, that the way you could get around this is if you could just have, I could know something was in the file that would be very helpful to me. I could turn to Susan and say, Susan, write me a letter and ask for that information. I turn around, write a letter and say, and then we say, now it's public. So we wanted to make clear and see that that's not what we're getting at either. We're talking about more broad dissemination prior to availability.
Ms. Clarkson,
I'm concerned about this because, in effect, what you've done is create two categories of public information. Disseminated public information and non-disseminated public information, and then said basically that a public employee may not disclose non-disseminated public information.
May not personally benefit themselves.
Interestingly enough, the term is benefit. It is not the term used throughout the Act, which is personal or financial benefit. That's going to be my second question. It's much looser. The officer's official duties that could result, that is not the term any place else that I've seen, and secondly, it's only benefit, not personal financial benefit. First of all, I question the division of public records into those two categories, and secondly, I think that if I were a public officer, I'd use this to refuse to release information to the public if I didn't want to release it.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that it could result in a benefit.
For
me or my immediate family.
I guess I don't understand how that would occur. Why would an employee, if someone came in and was public, how could they deny them access to information?
Just the information you described, land disposal information.
But we're talking about that in terms of that employee's ability to personally benefit, not anyone else who came in.
The employee wants to says he wants to apply for that land disposal and says, I'm not going to give it to you for that reason. I don't think that's the intent of the section. I just think that you've created some different standards here. First of all, by not inserting personal or financial benefits, and then the strange standard of could result in, which isn't the standard you used before. It was before, it was...
Yeah, we could certainly rewrite that to have it say that benefit of personal or financial interest, because that's what we're attempting. The term benefit is fairly broad, though.
Yeah,
it's still. But I don't see, Representative Clarkson, how it could be used to prohibit. I mean,
what it does is prohibit the disclosure of public information, and that's what I'm concerned about.
What it does is it creates in a sense, you're right, we are asking public employees or holding public employees to a higher standard, i.e., it may be available to the public, and it may be public information, but we're not allowing them as public employees to act upon that information unless first been communicated. It may be always public, but it's not being communicated. So we are, in a sense, saying, since you work for state government, and because we hold public servants to a higher standard, we're not going to allow you to benefit yourself personally or financially through the use of that information unless the public generally has had an opportunity to also know about that information and also benefit.
As I think through this, though, I'm not sure I agree with that principle. I mean, I think the ethics, the legislative ethics code, maybe it's not in there, but I think it's easy and quite correct to say that it is unethical to disclose confidential information.
Right, that's in here also.
For personal purposes. It's a much broader step to say that it's unethical to disclose public information under certain circumstances.
I can just give you one historical. This came out of, the Special Committee on Procurement and Ethics, and it was their request that it go further than simple availability. And it has resulted from that. And I mean, that's the policy.
It just reminded me, what happens if we get the whistleblower bill passed, which protects a public employee who discloses information that is negative to, that discloses some information about something that's going wrong, that is public information. The obvious personal benefit is that it helps protect their job or protect a project or whatever. This would prohibit the disclosure of what the whistleblower law protects from disclosure.
Let me just ask a question that could solve it. Why don't we just take out the words "may not disclose"? Why don't we just say a current or former public officer may not use this information? Because that's what we're trying to prohibit, is the personal use of the information. Actually, come to think of it, I don't know why I didn't see that word "disclose" before, but I don't see what value the word "disclose" even has in there. It's the use of that information that we're trying to.
In a sense, that's true. That's because the D covers the confidential information.
So if we took out the word "disclose" or, then
think about that. Okay. Hey, we'd be happy to.
I think that's important. The fact that you talked about it.
But I also agree with you, Representative Clarkson, that it's a policy consideration that so far legislative committees have agreed with, which is that availability is a step up to what people recognize. I mean, dissemination.
Can I have the rest of my time back? Can we break in?
Yeah, if there's anything more you want to say on this section, we'll take up this section again when we actually resume. I'm not sure when that's going to be.
Not the rest of my chat. I need to write more.
That's a gift, the benefits of which. Yeah, Mr. Taylor?
I know we've got to break up and move it, but it just seems to me that there's such a subtle distinction between what is a good or a proper act or activity on the part of the employee and what may be perceived to be an improper. The best example I can think of is the most recent controversy, and let's assume that building up in Fairbanks best building the state could possibly ever have, and it was in the state's best interest all the way around to get the building. And it just so happens that the governor happens to be good friends with and has been financially benefited from the fundraising benefits of the owner of the building or the owner's organization. And that that happens to be consequential. How is that scenario prevented from occurring under this legislation, or how is it not prevented from occurring under this legislation?
One of the allegations there was the release of a request for proposals prior to the time it was released to the public. I don't know that we ever proved that was true, but if it were true, it would be prohibited until it's been disseminated to the public.
There's another
I guess my concern is that as a governor, it's necessary at times to deal with all kinds of situations, like where you may want to be encouraging a particular industry, so you utilize the state funds to send Commissioner Lonsberry to Korea, you know, or you may want to be doing some other thing if you think the state really needs new office quarters in a particular city. And I just find it very difficult to distinguish between maybe the release of that PRM, what do they call those things, early, was an improper act. Maybe it didn't have any significance at all, because maybe they released the same thing 3 days behind that, and there was still adequate time within which everybody could get together and make their bid.
Or maybe there was no evidence of personal gain, which is also a criteria. There are other examples about giving information to industries that might want to develop here. You've got to show personal gain before it's prohibited.
Yeah.
Good result.
And yet personal gain really may not be hitting the nail on the head. If I could get every state employee to contribute to my birthday party at $100 for my campaign,
you'd have a very
I wouldn't have any
campaign.
Personal gain. That would be a nice campaign fund. It doesn't become personal gain until I take it personally. And it's exempted under this anyway. That's what I guess I'm getting at, is that it seems, especially on the executive branch, there may be many times where the executive needs to deal with industry or labor or someone in a business fashion, which may be beneficial to the state and yet could be viewed as unethical. And yet there'd be a little personal chaos.
What,
another 4 years in office is kind of it.
We're going to have to close with it. On that ponderous note, note to ponder on, I should say, we'll
I'd just like to be sure we don't.